both bhakti yoga and hatha yoga for about 20 years. And they've definitely transformed my life. I'm still a student for sure, a practitioner, but they've helped me in so many ways. And I don't really know what you've been talking about today exactly.
Talking about suffering.
Okay, the about suffering.
The modes of nature.
The modes of nature? Okay.
Yeah.
How struggle to be happy and.
Okay.
And our internal side of our who we are. The
okay.
Soul.
Okay.
The blissful nature of that.
Okay. So, how many of you are familiar with or practitioners of bhakti yoga to some degree? Okay. And everybody knows about it, or...
Okay.
We learned today.
You learned, okay, whatever you didn't know, you know now. Come a long way in a short time. Okay, fantastic. So we have a seasoned group of individuals here, elevated people, which is really nice. So thank you for letting me be in your presence and sharing whatever I have to offer with you today. I teach Hatha Yoga and many components that are involved with Hatha Yoga, like pranayama, which is a kind of breathing practice. And I try and incorporate teachings that go way beyond yoga on the mat. And I'm sure everybody's familiar with what yoga on the mat is. It's a way to just loosen up the body and free the mind so then we can actually sit and meditate and do our chanting and read our books of knowledge and connect with people and God the way that we should. So it's a vehicle, it's a tool, but in and of itself, it's not bhakti. And it's not really a way to, you know, connect with the divine, and it's not going to liberate us and take us back to a really amazing, you know, spiritual consciousness. But it's a stepping stone, and it's a very important stepping stone. And the Vedas, which is where I'm trying to get to with this, are this ancient, you didn't discuss this yet, body of knowledge from thousands of years ago that was compiled by rishis and sages and yogis from India. They didn't always compile it. I mean, thousands of years ago, they just used to talk it, you know, oral transmission, they say. But the compassion of those great spiritual thinkers and great elevated souls knew that down the road, cultures and generations later, there are going to be a group of people, just like us sitting in this room, who are going to need that knowledge. And we may not be of the caliber and quality and in the kind of society where we can receive it through oral transmission. So they decided, in the interest of society forever and ever, that they would write it down. And so that's what they did. So they compiled this incredible, vast body of knowledge that teaches people how to have a culture or a society or a community where you keep spiritual life in the center, but you can still go about doing your activities, raising your family, having your job, taking care of your animals, looking up in the sky and knowing what the galaxy is all about. So the Vedas are amazing. It's not just like a, you know, a religious text or something, although part of the Vedas are religious. But it teaches you everything, how to raise your animals, you know, how to look, how to understand astronomy, how to create a social arrangement so everybody's needs are met and there aren't like poor and hungry and dissatisfied people. Incredible body of knowledge. And one aspect of it, of course, is the yoga. And there are some very prominent people from the past who compile different aspects of yoga, be it bhakti yoga or hatha yoga, or there's like six different lines or branches of yoga. And there's one man, and this name might sound familiar to you. His name was Patanjali. And they sometimes call him the father of yoga. He lived the 3rd century before the birth of Christ. And he's famous for one book of knowledge called the Yoga Sutras. So I'll just write that down. And again, nobody's obligated to take notes on any of this. We're going to get to all that in a minute. So I'm just going to write the Yoga Sutras down here. That's his sort of great contribution to modern man. And his name was Patanjali. So Patanjali compiled these Yoga Sutras, and it's all about controlling the mind. Now, he does mention bhakti, he refers to bhakti, but the focus and the emphasis is not on bhakti. You talked about bhakti, right?
A little bit.
Okay. This is called the Bhakti Weekend. Okay. So if I keep saying
a lot about suffering.
That's becoming right.
That's interesting. So we'll want to go for the solution of bhakti.
Yeah, okay. Okay, I hope this is a good transition. That's what he talked about. It's very scholarly and very intellectual. They're 290-something sutras. Sutra means like an aphorism that explains different aspects of the body and the mind and relating to the external world and the internal world. And it's not that interesting, to be frank, unless you're super scholarly. You know, if you really love like technical, scholarly, intellectual things and terms, lots of Sanskrit, then, you know, it might interest you. But for me, the golden nuggets of what Patanjali taught are what we call the yamas and the niyamas. And we're going to discuss what they are. Now, the translation of yamas is precepts of social discipline. And that sounds very technical, doesn't it? And very sort of like something you would find in a church or a hospital or something. But to me, what that really means is behaviors that help us grow, that help us evolve, and help us find harmony and health and well-being. That's what they are. They're behaviors to teach us how to become better people. It's a foundation. The yamas and the niyamas are like foundations for skillful living. And who, you know, couldn't use with a little more skillful living? So that's what they're really about. The literal translation for yama is restraint. But again, like I said, in our modern world, it's really about how to find peace with ourselves, with our family, and with our community. And that's what the yamas and the niyamas are tools to help us achieve those goals. And they're part of a yoga system. And they are great for helping us achieve bhakti, which is, I guess you're going to learn that later tomorrow. So let's start with the first one. Does anybody want to tell me what, recite it in Sanskrit and tell me what the English means?
Ahimsa, nonviolence.
Nonviolence, yes. So what does nonviolence mean? I know we don't have that much time, so we have to keep it a little bit on track. But Patanjali says there's four different ways to engage in violence. And there's four ways to restrain. One way is violence to other people and all sentient beings. And of course, that would include animals. So that would bring us to the topic of, being vegetarian, meat eating, refraining from violence to other living entities that feel it. And you just can't escape vegetarianism in a true, authentic yoga path or practice. I mean, there are lots of people that are very good at doing, sophisticated calisthenics on their yoga mat. But there's no yoga tradition that doesn't promote vegetarianism. You just can't escape it. So Does anybody have any questions about that or issues with that? Because this can be a discussion. I don't want to just make it a lecture. I would love to hear your contributions. So I'm open if anybody has any. I mean, I don't know who's
before,
a vegetarian.
Before lunch,
so.
We got a little explanation on why we should be vegetarian.
I'm not I mean, is anybody honest enough here to say they're not a vegetarian?
I'm a pescatarian.
A what?
A pescatarian.
Pescatarian.
Eat fish.
You eat fish, okay.
I never heard of that term.
Me neither.
I heard vegetarian.
Okay, so thank you for being honest. We won't get into a whole thing about eating fish right now, but I think the fact that maybe you, because you only eat fish, you have some sense that, you know, it's a more evolved lifestyle and dietary choice to not eat animals. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so human beings and sentient beings, ourselves, committing violence to ourselves. We commit so much violence to ourselves, mentally, physically, emotionally. We're really good at beating ourselves up. But the sages say that that's violence. So we have to learn how to skillfully stop doing that. We need to learn the skills so we can stop beating ourselves up.
Is that equated with self-esteem at all?
Yeah. It can be equated with self-esteem. Yeah.
But violence, but they're not taking care of your health, that's...
Yeah, we're going to get there. Yeah. Well, the self means the body. It means all parts of ourselves. And you're going to see how all the yamas and niyamas overlap and interlace with each other. But, yeah, who wants to say something about how we commit violence to ourselves? Anybody have an example?
Overeating.
Because what does that do?
Harms the body, harms the entire system.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Not exercising.
Yeah.
Intoxication.
Intoxication. How does that harm the self? Toxins in your body. It clouds the clear thinking consciousness that we have, prevents us from making clear, good, uplifting choices. What about more like a self, what's the word? When we harm ourselves internally, not so much the body, but emotionally and psychologically, when we really torture ourselves. Like self-criticism.
Let things cause anxiety.
Anxiety, yeah. That's a good one. Okay, good. So the self, the sentient beings, the environment, also hurting the environment is considered to be violence. And we're living in a world now that's full of so much violence towards the environment. And I think there's one more. Ahimsa also means to be tolerant of things that you don't necessarily like. Things that may not please us or, you know, be tasteful to us, but to be tolerant of that. Okay, so next is, who wants to say?
Satya.
Does anyone know what that means?
Is it goodness?
Truthfulness, to be truthful. And Patanjali describes Satya as not deceiving people through our words, our thoughts, and our actions. It's a deception or a deceiving. Because truthfulness is a huge topic. And we, you know, there have been books written about it and debates carried on about it. And we in this room for a whole day could talk about what really constitutes truthfulness. Because sometimes when we're too honest, we speak the actual truth, we really hurt people, you know, deeply hurt them. And then when we're not truthful, you know, there's just so many layers and so many gradations and variations of the truth. There's this one yoga teacher, her name is Sally Kempton, and she writes for a magazine called The Yoga Journal. And she decided to do a monthly experiment where she would, for that whole month, not tell one lie and not speak one untruth. And so the first day, she just kept finding herself over and over in her exchanges just not being completely honest and truthful. And she realized how she was going around living her life with so many unnecessary untruths, just unnecessary. So that's something that we all might want to try, even just for a day, or to speak of a month, is just to stick to honest, caring, compassionate truth. And again, it's the deception in our minds when we're communicating with people, when we're explaining things to them, sharing things to them. What's going through our mind? Are we trying to deceive them? That's the real barometer for the truthfulness. Anyone want to throw something in?
I was smiling when you said that because I remember reading a thing. They did a study about how much people lie at work, and it was like such a high percentage, like everything almost that came out of their mouths was some exaggerated truth to be looking a certain way with their coworkers.
Right.
And it blew my mind because I was thinking that like they were saying like upward of 70% of what people were saying were
lies.
Lies.
Yeah. Yeah. We don't even know we're doing it. Yeah. Yeah. Over exaggeration or just trying to get out of something, wiggle your way out of something. Now, children are the best people to be around to catch you in a lie and to make you not lie. They just won't tolerate it. And it's just one little thing. You know, you're on the phone and you say, I have to go because something, something. And they'll say, that's not true. You know, or, you know, whatever it is, from the littlest to the biggest, they're pure. You know, they're pure-hearted. They haven't quite fallen into that trap. So think like a child. You know, be around children and immediately you won't be able to say those little lies, because little ones turn into medium ones and medium ones turn into big ones. And then before we know it, we're just in a quagmire of dishonesty. And when we're dishonest with others, we can't be honest with ourselves. Or when we're dishonest with ourselves, it's really hard to be dishonest with, really hard to be honest with others. So these are all topics and subjects for you later to contemplate on. You know, I'm just giving you a brief overview, but they're definitely meant for deeper contemplation and how they're applicable in your own life and, you know, judge yourself. You know, do your own test, your own barometer test from a scale of 1 to 10. You know, where am I in this yama? And we'll get to the niyamas. Where am I in this niyama? Am I, you know, doing good? Am I doing great? Am I really off the track? And then slowly through this whole workshop, hopefully you'll feel inspired to, you know, get on the track with these codes or ethics for living a skillful, peaceful life. Okay, asteya. That means non-stealing. And basically what that means is not taking more than what is given to you. So are there any... We'll just keep going unless... I mean, there are certain ones that we'll talk more about than others, but in the interest of time, we don't have to discuss...
How does that work in relation to just achieving something? You're working towards something. So it's not given to you, you're achieving it, you're creating it, you're obtaining it by your effort. So,
well, it's more in connection with objects and things that, you know, don't belong to you, but you want them, and you don't need them.
Well, I could buy a lot of things that I don't need. Is that the same thing?
Well, it's connected to aparigraha, which is the last one, and you'll see how they're connected. So the fourth one is called brahmacharya, and that means sexual responsibility. And what that means is a few things. It means not seeing either a man or a woman as the object of your enjoyment, you know, for your senses to enjoy, but rather see them as a human being, and even beyond that, see them as a divine being. Brahmacharya also means to reserve your energy, reserve your sexual energy, and reserve your energy, period. Now, in Ayurveda, which is the ancient system of medicine that comes from the Vedas, they talk about this substance called ojas, O-J-A-S. Ojas is kind of, you could compare it to like a nectar, like a liquid nectar, honey substance that every human being is born with. And we're sort of just born with a certain amount. And every time man or woman engages in the engages in sex, they lose some of their ojas. And the ojas is what gives people vitality. It gives them energy. It makes them alive and vital. And that's why we see historically that people who were very strict in their sexual habits, like brahmacharis, people who, you know, some people never had sex in their whole lives. Like, they chose that. They're celibate. And they chose it. It's not because they couldn't find a mate. They didn't, you know, they were just pursuing spiritual life. Those people tend to live really, really long. They have extremely long lives, and they don't have so many health problems. So the more we do engage in sexual activities, the more ojas we lose, and it's sort of, you know, the symptoms are just like a lack of beautiful, bright luster in the eyes, or very dry skin, or just, you know, a lack of that bright, shiny, energetic, beautiful person. So the yogis say, reserve your ojas, because it's what gives you the life and the energy to pursue your goals, you know, to do the things that you want to do. And not only reserving our sexual energy, but energy in general, for instance, just chatter. You know, have you ever been in just this like long, chattery conversation with somebody and you just feel so drained? And you're like, God, I wish I had gotten out of that, you know, way long ago. Has everybody had that experience?
When I have to talk to my mother.
That's a possibility. So that's a lack of brahmacharya. You know, I mean, you have to do that as a duty with your mom, but it's just, you know, endless chit-chat for no reason. It saps us of our life force. So that's also brahmacharya. Yeah.
Is there a way to gain some of that ojas?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And there is. I mean, there are Ayurvedic practices that can help, you know, I don't know if I'm going to say increase the ojas. It's not like you're going to just get like this whole new batch of it, but it's going to help sort of make it last longer. And there are certain foods to eat, and there are certain practices like certain yoga postures and certain breathing techniques and certain mantras that we can chant. And that's, maybe we can have that conversation another time. But yes, there are things to do that can preserve whatever ojas you still have and make it go a little bit longer. Yeah, and that's something you can even Google. It's not like I have that special information. No one else has it. You can Google it. Preserving ojas.
Is it a raw food diet?
No, not at all, because Ayurveda doesn't promote raw food diets at all. But it's foods like dates, eating dates and eating milk products, things that are very sweet and rich and creamy, just in terms of food. Yeah, it's not, yeah. Okay, so aparigraha means not being covetous, non-covetousness, or not accumulating more than is necessary, especially stuff. You know, we live in the world, the society, the age of stuff. It's all about getting more stuff. And then when you have more stuff, you gotta like manage it and figure out where to keep it and what to do with it. And really, it's just a big distraction from focusing on the more important things in life. And the yogis, the rishis, the sages, they say, just have what you need. You know, don't try and accumulate more than you really need. And then there's like this little saying, simple living, high thinking, because it's really hard to think about personal spiritual evolution when you're just immersed with so much stuff, you know, like pat racks, rat packs. What's it called? Pack rats. Yeah, does anybody know a pack rat where they just want to keep everything? Or anybody, you know, somebody who their house is just like cluttered with stuff. They love accumulating. So that is an obstacle. That is not something favorable for, you know, just living a simple life dedicated to higher knowledge. So try not to accumulate more than you need to, and to covet other people's things. You know, wishing like, oh, I wish I had that, and I want to get that, because that becomes the meditation. I don't know if you've done any meditating yet, but you can only think about one thing at a time, really. So you can be thinking about that thing that you really want and get like obsess about it, or you can be thinking about more valuable, practical, productive, elevating things. So it's a distraction from focusing on spiritual life.
So all of these, is he presenting these in the context that if you want to meditate, particularly if you want to gain more control of your mind, all of these things will agitate the mind so that it's going to upset your meditation? So if you're doing all the principles of meditation, if you don't live these principles, then these things will all agitate your mind and you won't be able
They
to.
Will. They will. You won't be able to meditate, and you just won't be able to, you know, be of service in the world. I mean, to the degree that we sort of are not able to practice these yamas, to that degree we are disabling ourselves to be of service to God and God's people and to the world at hand. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. And when we are connected to our source, when we are living as connected to our source, to our divine nature, to that degree, we are able to follow the yamas when we're connected to our source and to our own personal contribution and service and a mission in service to the source. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Isn't there another aspect of if you do your chanting, then this will also be a byproduct of it, the correlation between making the effort to do it and then the meditation that brings you up to that level, that helps you, empowers you, gives you the grace to get there?
Definitely. Good point. Yeah.
It's like they kind of support
one. They work together. They work hand in hand. Absolutely. You talked about the chanting.
We chanted twice.
What did you chant?
Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare.
On the beads, or just, yeah.
Yeah,
so that's going to have a real effect on how we, you know, you think about these before you chant some Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, And then you chant, let's say, for 10, 15, 20 minutes. My daughter chanted for 2 hours today. You did the beads, right? So you did one round? Well, she chanted 16 rounds today and yesterday. And she decided for the month of Kartik, which is this 1 month, that's like a special spiritual month, and people take vows to do extra special things. She's going to chant 16 rounds every day. And she goes to school and takes violin and takes this and that and the other.
How old she is.
Oh, she's 9. Sorry. I forgot that part. Yeah. She's 30.
We were going to try to get her to teach you how to chant, but...
Well, I'll tell you a funny story. So, so the way you're going to think about chant, the way you're going to think about these before you're chanting, because the chanting is so purifying, it's so heart-opening, and it frees you of a lot of material desires. Then you look at this app, and you're like, yeah, I really feel more enlivened to follow this from a core level, not just from an external level. I mean, you know, I'm kind of sharing this with you sort of on a superficial level. It's got to come from the core. But I'll tell you another funny story related to our daughter is that, I have to keep it short, I had to figure out a child care situation for her today. And she's been on crutches and had a cast because she hurt her heel dancing. So I've been trying to think of more sedentary things for her to do, beading and just different activities, crafts. And she can't go around with her friends so much because friends want to run around and do things. But sometimes friends will come over and they'll play like every board game known to man. So I thought, okay, well, for today, what I'll do is arrange for her to go with some friends and her mom to a movie. So she was like, okay. So she chanted her 16 rounds yesterday. And then she chanted her 16 rounds today. And she was probably in tears because she didn't want to go to the movie. Because she just thought, you know, I don't want to go to a movie and sit there and watch like some story about some people. Like, it wasn't enlivening to her soul. She had to go because I had already arranged it. She was very upset that I was sending, and it was a wholesome family movie, Nanny McPhee, Nanny and the kids, and they save the pigs. But she was, and it was a result of the chanting, because yesterday after 16 rounds, she was upset about the movie, and then today she was double upset. And so I just thought it really works, the chant, because she just wanted to chant, you know, and it was just interesting. So I think the chanting has a big effect on the choices we're going to make in our lives. And, you know, a movie's a little choice, but, you know, all the little choices they accumulate into big choices.
Well, you know, on that note, I mean...
Not like there's anything wrong with movies, by the way. Okay, sorry.
Yeah, I mean, what I find is that sometimes, you know, when I have a regular chanting program, you know, I'm practicing spiritual life, but... it's like, I hope this doesn't come across wrong, but it's like, at least the satisfaction part of life is taken care of. Now you just need to take care of other stuff. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You know, it sounds kind of odd.
No.
But I regularly have that experience. Like, you know, you take care of the satisfaction. Because the quality of all your other experiences are, first of all...
It's like when I would meet people... And I would explain to them what I do. And after I explained to them what I do, then they say, well, what do you do for fun? That was always, you know, I say, well, I get up and I chant and I do this and I do that. And then they say, so where's the fun? And I think, I didn't have to do anything for fun.
That is fun.
It's beyond fun. It's not even in the, like...
The material fun realm.
It's not even the categories. As we said, a lot of the fun is just so you forget the... stuff you want to forget.
Hmm.
So it's interesting.
It's just interesting how, I guess people who practice, you know, chanting and experiences like that, when you try to explain that to somebody who hasn't, you're just talking in a different vocabulary, you know? And, I mean, it is literally like, you know, if you eat a lychee, has everybody eaten a lychee? Does everybody know what a lychee is?
No.
Okay. It's a specific type of fruit that you get in Asia. I mean, I've had it here also, but It's quite a
like a
rare
grape with skin that looks like an alligator.
Yeah, but it tastes very good.
It's super sweet and yummy. Yeah. They're delicious. Yeah.
But like I said, I mean, if you haven't had a lychee, I mean, you know, I could describe it, and you know, I mean, it could sound like it's something that you get in Mars or a science fiction movie, you know.
Mm.
And I think a lot of people, when you talk to them about chanting, and you know, what it does, you know, they kind of treat you like, oh, it's wishful thinking.
Hmm.
You know, if you haven't experienced it, it's like, okay, I guess you're just like kind of rah-rah positiving yourself into that mood kind of thing.
So they may not, they haven't had the experience themselves, so it's hard for them to really believe you or...
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes it's hard for me to believe it. I mean, you know, I mean, I guess what I'm trying to say, you know, I'm a student of science and all that, and then, but it's just, you know, sometimes it's like, wow. You know, if I didn't experience it, I wouldn't believe it.
There was one time when a psychology professor was studying the effects of the Maha Mantra. Doing a study, you know, how does it affect the body, the mind, and so forth. And they explained that to my spiritual master. He said they can't study it that way. It won't show what it's actually doing. Because it's working on a spiritual level, and they can only see its byproducts on the material level. You know, so some people might say, yeah, it's good, it calms you down. That's not the ultimate goal.
Right.
You know, your heart rate changes, your mind waves change. But that's the physical manifestation. They can't see the spiritual.
So the takeaway from this little conversation is that when we engage in genuine spiritual practices in a sincere way, something as simple as chanting ancient spiritual mantras, then our desires and needs decrease for material things. And does that make sense? Yeah, we need less. You know, you don't need as much. Your interests just, yeah, you're cooling the fire.
Can I tell a story?
Yeah.
So, who knows about Dhruva Maharaj? Who's heard of Dhruva Maharaj? Dhruva Maharaj was a prince who was rejected by his father because his stepmother didn't like him. And because he was raised as a prince, he had a warrior mentality. So he took revenge against his father. And he said, I will get a kingdom even greater than my father's. So I'll become more powerful than him. That was his desire. So he went to his mother and said, this is my desire. How do I do that? And then he said, this is my desire, and I want to find God. And when I find God, I'll ask him. So I'll ask God, give me a kingdom greater than my father's. He was just so angry. So he asked his mother, he said, where can I find God? He said, well, the sages, they go to the forest to meditate. So they find him out there. So he was only 5. And he went out to the forest. And so he was doing his meditation. It's just silent meditation. And he was focusing on God within the heart, with this prayer, this intention, that I want you to come out of my heart and ask me what I want, and then I'll tell you what I want, which is this kingdom. So at that time, there was a sage who saw him meditating. And he said, what are you doing out here? You're only 5. You should be home. It's dangerous. And so he said, well, I'm meditating. Could you show me, could you give me a mantra or show me a way that I could find God? He said, I could, but you're too young. You should go home. So actually what he was doing, he was just testing him. He was trying to get him to go back home to see if he was determined. So this little 5-year-old boy said, if you can't tell me how to see God, why don't you just leave? Because I don't need you. So, you know, he showed his determination. So I believe he gave him a mantra. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. He was given this mantra. You chant this mantra. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. And he chanted this mantra. And so he was meditating on God within his heart. And all of a sudden, that form went outside of him. He saw this form. It's called Vishnu. He saw this form of God. And God said, now I've come to you to fulfill your desire to have a greater kingdom than your father. And at that point, he said, I don't want anything because I've seen you. And now I'm satisfied. And then he said, my desire was like broken pieces of glass and you're like a diamond. So why should I want that? So that story exemplifies that what seems valuable materially when you come to a spiritual level is like it's insignificant as a broken glass. And at one point in your life, this is everything you wanted. Because you valued it so much that this is where my real happiness is going to be in these broken pieces of glass. This is where my happiness is. And then you get something better. Of course, you thought it was a diamond. You get something better. And you see, this is like glass. This is nothing. But Vishnu said, no, I know what you want, and I'm going to give it to you anyway. So sometimes it works that way. Sometimes, I have to tell you this, I don't know if you relate to this, but it's so funny. When I was young, I grew up by the beach, and you know, where I lived in California, anywhere by the beach, most of the young people go surfing. So I did that. And all the surfers, they dream of going to these exotic islands and just like living like beach folks. They make a few $1,000 and just go and live as long as you can some island, you know, sip coconuts and go surfing. As like every surfer wants to do that, you know, just make some money and go surfing. Travel around the world. So you know, that desire was there, you know, but I gave that up and practicing spiritual life. But you know, when you give up something, there's some seed of desire, it just doesn't go away. So then 20 or odd years ago, I was put in charge of a center on an island in Africa. That was exactly the kind of island that I would want to go to. And I had a friend, that I met personally, he said, you want to go to the beach to see where they surf? And I said, okay. So I went, and there was like perfect wave. You know, it was just like this paradise, and I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, but I don't want this anymore. It was like I felt just like that story. When you say, okay, Drew, but here, you can have what you want. And I said, but I don't want it anymore. So sometimes when you come to this point where you're detached, because God knows what you want, I said, okay, I know you wanted this, so here, let me give it to you. And then it won't bewilder you, but when you're attached and you get it, it tends to bewilder you. You might give up your spiritual life.
I was going to say a quick line was, you know, when we're starving, food has a very disproportionate value. And when we're full, you know, the same food has a very proportionate value. So I think, you know, spiritual satisfaction is kind of like that.
Yeah,
that's
really
nice. Yeah.
Important.
Yeah. Should we move on? Okay. So the niyamas. These are the precepts of discipline for the self, for the individual. The yamas were for society or culture or, you know, others. This is more from within. Social precepts for the individual. Okay. So the first one is suci, which means purity. So make sure you brush your teeth and wash your hair and, you know, do all those really important things and then you're ready. Actually, what it means is that too, keeping the body clean and keeping your environment clean, like your house. So everybody can think about, you know, the environment affects us so much. So, you know, externally where we live, you know, the condition of our desk and our this and our that. I mean, that's just part of suci. And you can think about how different you feel after you've cleaned your house or your bathroom or your desk. You just immediately feel better, don't you? So it has such an effect on the consciousness. And it also refers to internal consciousness, the mind, you know, the kind of thoughts that we have, or the thoughts we have uplifting or degrading. Are they polluting or are they, you know, energizing? And then also how we think about others. You know, what are we thinking about others? That all has to do with purity. Purity of mind, purity of body, and even eating. You know, we talked about that a little bit, about how we feel when we overeat. So what kind of food are we eating? Are we eating food that is healthy and fresh? Or are we eating food that's old and, you know, shouldn't be eaten, should be put in the compost? It's a lifestyle, you know, when you think about it, how far the concept of suci extends in every aspect of our life, literally from our body to the clothes that we're wearing, or did we wear them last week or yesterday, or, you know, are they clean, are they fresh, to, you know, the condition of our house and our cabinets and everything. Is it orderly? Is it clean? Is it organized? Is it fresh? Or is it just chaotic? To the way we think. Suci is really important for spiritual life. Comments? Questions? Anyone want to add anything about that?
Yeah. Well, one thing I would say is, whenever in modern world we talk about quality of living, it's more associated with economics. You know, what's the quality of, how do you put it, quality of life you enjoy here?
Mm-hmm.
Is that the term? But it's kind of interesting how, you know, I mean, the things that you're mentioning, it's kind of quality of life that doesn't have to do with, it's more lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
And the lifestyle is not necessarily has to do with money, but more choices, I guess.
Yeah. Yep. I mean, everybody feels the difference when they're feeling clean and they're dirty. And, you know, on every level, it's just, it really affects our consciousness. And bhakti, you know, bhakti is a very high thing. And to achieve it, the consciousness has to be very high and very pure. So these are steps to get us closer to achieving bhakti, which is, did you talk about what it means? Yeah. So, to get there.
Another thing someone told me, said a lot of times at the end of the day they want to chant, but it's very difficult because so much has gone on in the day. And they said what they'll do is they'll take a shower. Mm-hmm. And after they take a shower, it kind of balances the body and the mind, and they can chant.
Definitely.
Kind of like you washed off the day from your mind by that water.
In the Vedic society, they have this one class of people called the Brahmins, if that's a familiar term. They were the teachers, the you know, people who gave out knowledge and were the educators. And they considered it such a honor and a responsibility that the Brahmins had to be the most pure in mind, in heart, and even in body. So they had really high standards for the teachers, for the educators, for the givers of knowledge. And they would take like 3 showers a day. You know, they would only eat the food that they personally cooked, because they knew their consciousness, what they were thinking about, what they were meditating on while they were preparing for food. Have you ever gone into a restaurant to eat and, you know, you look at the food and you eat the food and you feel like you don't feel good after you eat it, and you kind of just think that maybe the people, the cooks in the back, like, what were they doing? What were they thinking about? What were they talking about? Have you ever had that experience? That's how consciousness can go into food. So the Brahmins were really careful. They only ate their own food. They bathed. And that enabled them to be very, you talked about the mode of goodness, be in the mode of goodness, which enabled them to be givers of knowledge. Even my daughter, you know, when she gets kind of tired after a whole long day of school, but she still has all these practices or homework or lessons, she just knows, take a shower. Mm-hmm. She just goes to take a shower and has a nice snack, you know, and she just feels better. Or, you know, if her room gets too dirty and chaotic and we can't find the homework, we know it's time to clean the room. So cleanliness can, or purity or cleanliness can really make a huge shift in consciousness that can take us from being very tired and sort of lacking energy and hard to move in the world to feeling really bright and energetic and uplifted and enthusiastic. So, yeah.
Okay,
so santosh. Santosh, God bless you, means contentment. And the way Patanjali explains that is that we should be content with our external circumstances, our situation in life, but not complacent. Because complacency can lead to the mode of ignorance. You talked about the modes, right? So just being too lazy to do anything about it, that's not contentment. That's complacency. But contentment is just being content and not wishing and hoping and hankering and, you know, being disturbed by a situation that we may not have control over. Okay?
Isn't it also kind of the acceptance of this is what I have? This is...
Yeah, acceptance. Mm-hmm.
This is the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
And that even if I make the effort to improve, but whatever the result is, it's the way it is. Otherwise, you're always caught in this grass is greener.
Definitely.
The never ending. The never ending itch.
Yep. Yeah, it's a balancing act. It's a fine line between being in the mode of passion, being in the mode of ignorance, and being in santosh. Okay. Tapas. Anyone? I forgot to ask who knows what that means and to say the word. What's that?
Heat?
Does mean heat.
Does it?
It's one of the meanings.
Yeah. Okay. That's not this meaning, but thank you for...
Austerity?
Yeah. Yeah, the fire, I guess. The fire.
Sacrifice.
Sacrifice, yeah. So austerity.
We do a fire sacrifice.
Yeah,
heat.
Yeah.
No, but also, I think also the connotation of heat is in the sense of pain or doing something that's pain, that may be somewhat painful but beneficial.
You know, Sanskrit.
Like fasting.
Thank you.
What did she say?
Just that she offered a heat. It was a whole new. Well, in this particular context, it means commitment to a spiritual practice. That's what it means. A commitment to your spiritual discipline.
We just had this, there's a devotee that's a Sanskrit teacher, and he just taught us about that when Lord Brahma was sitting on the lotus flower of this creation process, and he heard the word tapa, and he was saying that it was actually meaning to perform. Mm. It's a verb, which means action.
Mm.
That was one of the things that I remember.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Must do kind of thing.
Must do, yeah. Commitment, discipline. So swadhyaya, it's a little hard to pronounce, swadhyaya, means self-study. And I like this because I think one of the things that separates humans from all the other sentient beings around the planet is that we can engage in self-study. You know, we can ask ourselves the three questions that every human being asks themselves, but some of us ask it and then, you know, push it down away from our conscious self, and some of us sort of let it linger around, wondering how far we should pursue it, and then some of us actually, you know, pursue it. And those three questions are, who am I? Where do I come from? And where am I going? I mean, that's the beauty of being a human being, is that we have that ability. So Swadhyaya, self-study, has a couple of different aspects to it. And one is to study ourselves and to ask ourselves these questions. Another aspect is to, let me see, I think I have to read something because my brain. Okay, so one is contemplation, which is studying the self. One is spiritual education, which is like what we're doing today. And then the other aspect is practical application of these sacred texts that you may be reading and learning. So that's self-study.
Can you talk more about the aspect of studying yourself? Is that self-examination, or is that...
It's contemplation. Yeah, it's.
But yourself as a spiritual being, or just.
Well,
the
both.
Whole, the whole thing.
Both. It's part of the spiritual education. You're going to be studying about yourself, and then the contemplation is when you take the time personally to, you know, analyze and what's the word? To analyze and reflect and decide, you know, where you're at and where you need to go. And let's all combine. Is that okay?
Those questions that you were saying?
Yeah.
Where
do I come from and where am I going? That's part of self-study.
Is it?
And the answers will be revealed to you through all those practices. The study of the spiritual education, the contemplation, and then the application of the sacred texts. That's how the answers of those three questions become revealed to you.
I remember hearing one time that our spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada, said that 40% is what you say, but actually 60% is what you do. So like the education of jnana or knowledge that you're getting, but then acting on that knowledge or applying it, that's like the full step.
Yeah.
So to really study is to act on that knowledge.
So applying practical application of the text that one may be studying. Yeah. Okay. Okay, and then Ishvara Pranidhana. That's the final niyama. Does anybody want to offer our Sanskrit scholar over here? I never even got people's names.
Pranidhana?
Yeah.
Ishvara means
I can't break up the...
Right? Controller?
Yeah, supreme... It can mean controller. It can mean God or...
Enjoyer.
Meditation? Meditating in the heart?
No.
Prana.
I mean, it may be that too. I don't know. I'm just giving the...
Prana is breath? No.
Life force.
Force, yeah. So what it means is acknowledging that there is a higher, more powerful divine force than ourselves. That we are very small and God is very great. And along with that, one must cultivate humility and let go of this like egoism or the false ego, you know, the thing that puffs us up to make us go out in the world and every day and I can do it and I'm good and I'm beautiful and I'm smart and I can get that job and I can, you know, we have to do all that, but we don't have to puff ourselves up to do it. We just go to the source, connect with the source, be humble, you know, be a humble instrument of the source. And, you know, we don't have to fight for our rights. And, I mean, at least not in this country generally, you know. we're not in that place where we have to be so defensive and so, you know, dependent on this big sense of I'm so great and I'm so powerful and my ego is just going to make it. We don't have to do that. We can realize we're very small and God is very great and live with that. We'll get further and accomplish more and find more, you know, happiness doing that. Because it's just true. You go to the mountain, you go to the beach, you go somewhere that's so great and so grand and so beautiful. And what's the first thought everybody has?
How God made this.
Or just how incredible it is. Yeah. Right? Oh my God, that mountain is so beautiful. It's so big and I'm so teeny. So it's all around us. God's greatness is all around us. And what makes us great is that, you know, we're part of God, is that we have a service we can offer God, but with, you know, humility. So that concludes our... I have nothing else. It's a blank page. Are there any questions or anything? And if there's any time, I want to tell a story, only if there's time, though.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, the last point you're making, Richard. We get to talk about more because you know there's a sense of I have to have an intention and a determination to do something, and without that it will never happen. And then you're saying at the same time you have to acknowledge to what degree you have control over the result and thereby determine how much energy to put or not put in. So I think it'd be good to discuss that. And I just wanted to mention one thing in relation to that, that I noticed that when I'm in India and we talk about these things, if somebody's done something wonderful and they're talking about it, they'll always go like this. They go look up to the sky and they go, it's all his
people who are from India, like Indian people.
Yeah,
okay. Not us.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know when they come to America if everything changes, but at least in India, when you're talking, you know, it's so wonderful you've done this, or how did you do this, or how are you going to do this difficult thing, they'll go. It's all up to him. It's just like, they naturally do that, right? Mm-hmm. It's all up to him, right? Where in America, it's like, me. You know, I'm going to do it because I have the intelligence, the determination. And so it seems that it's actually not entirely all up to him because you have to do something, and it's not entirely all up to you because he's in control. So maybe you could just talk about...
Maybe you can talk about it. You seem to be on a roll.
Well, I think there's a tendency of a more materialistic culture to think that, you know, the whole idea is that you're just a skill or two away or a bit of information away from success, and it's entirely or predominantly dependent on you. And I think it's a symptom of a culture that is spiritual to acknowledge, yes, that's true, but that ultimately it's not up to you because there's a certain point where you have no control. And that there's a level of faith and realization that it's by divine grace that I can do anything. Even the intelligence I have to come up with the idea. It's not ultimately me. It came to me. Just like, did you ever get an idea? It just comes to you? So where did it come from? It just came. This idea. You got a really good idea for that. For Velcro. I got this idea for Velcro. It's going to be big. You know? And that's it. I got this idea for Post-its. Where did it come from? Right? The guy's like multi-billion zillionaire discovered Post-its or Velcro. It wasn't like they were just, you know, writing down ideas. It's just like the Velcro guy, a burr got stuck to his dog and was pulling it out. And he got, pew, this idea came. So I think it's in countries and in people who are more spiritual, they just recognize that it's not me, it's a symbol. Whereas in more materialist countries, they tend to want to acknowledge, no, it's me. I came up with this idea. It's my intelligence. But it's really the balance that according to what we want, God supplies. Like you said, if you're lazy, then you're not going to, there'll be no ambition. So why will God give you ambition if you don't want it? So there seems to be a balance. What? I don't know who said this. Well, maybe Catholic monk. He said, act like everything depends on you. And pray like everything depends on God. So it's like this. I have to make the effort, but I'm not the controller. So that's a perfect balance. And if you get out of balance, then what happens is you'll just pray and do nothing. You won't make any effort. And say, well, if God is supposed to do it, I'll just pray. He'll come down on an airplane and he'll make everything happen. So you get that extreme. As opposed to the other extreme, well, I don't need God. I can do it myself. And then my spiritual master used to say that in what happens in very materialistic countries when they become very technologically advanced, they begin to think that spirituality is just, it's for weak people because we've created this ideal environment. We don't really need anything else. We don't need a God. Look at, we've got nice cars, nice roads, and hospitals. And we can figure it all out. But they don't realize whatever they figured out came from him. That without him, they couldn't figure it out. But they tend to want to push that out of the way and say, you know, look, all, and some philosophers say that religion was a byproduct of ignorance. People didn't understand how the universe worked. So the only way they could explain it was through God, because they didn't have the scientific information. But now we have the scientific information. We know how the universe works. We know how the laws of nature work, how gravity works, how chemicals combine, and so forth. So now we understand there is no God. It's just natural law. And the dependence on God is just because we didn't know that. So that's the extreme of materialism. Then you think, you don't really need God, and God was just the crutch, and now we know we can just control everything in the universe, and we're just, you know, a few years away from the next experiment that will help us do the next thing, find the next cure, or inhabit another planet, or like that.
Well, you know, now we know how to shape everything except ourselves. Mm.
Yeah, it's like, I think it's really good if you're practicing spiritual life to study a little history of ancient cultures, because they're so much different. There's so much wisdom in ancient cultures that's not in our culture. It's just like everything we're talking about in many ancient cultures, everybody knew that. It's just like, this is like common knowledge. You know? But because our culture's got so materialistic, it's so dysfunctional now. So, you know, we don't try to improve ourselves. Right? We just try to manipulate energy. That's our success, the more we can live. And then we become blind to higher values. And then what do we say? What's the conclusion? After we die, there's nothing. That's the ultimate conclusion of materialistic society. When you die, you're finished. It's all over. So one great spiritual master, he said, when you have a culture like that, then what happens is, this paradox happens, is that the higher a person is educated, the more ignorant they become. Because the more they know, the more they don't know. Because the more they know, the more they think they're like God. And they don't need God. So actually they become more foolish. I was watching this video, I think it was in Nepal, this video. It was really interesting. They're asking people about life. So they asked one man about life. It's like a 20-year-old, he said, as soon as you're born, your death is hovering over your shoulders. And according to your karma, it will attack you. He asked another little boy, "What? Tell us something." He said, "You're a soul, you're not a body." Like an 8-year-old boy. These are village people, very simple people, not university educated. And they're asking him all these questions, and they had all these answers. And I was watching this, and I was thinking, okay, here's these simple village people, a little village in Nepal. And you go into the biggest universities in America, and university professors don't even know this. They'll argue against it. There's no God, there's no soul, there's no karma. I just thought it was very interesting to see how these traditional cultures are so wise. and our so-called powerful country is so foolish. You know, I was listening to a lecture by a professor. He said, if you study Roman history and Greek history, it was the most similar country to America in every way. They were the dominant power, economic, world power. They were the most materially advanced. They had the most. He said, what happened to that culture? He said, if you study history, you will see that someday America will end up where the Roman Empire ended up. It will fall apart because of immorality, because of debt, because of all the wrong principles. That was interesting. You know, we think, oh, America's going to be here forever. He said, it's not going to be here forever. Not the way we're living.
When you did this with the Indians, they say to God, remind me of like modern medicine, that they don't have a cure for drug addiction. And they, when they bring addicts to therapy, one of the things that the therapy organizations, which actually are interesting because most of them, their disposition for when they discharge an addict is not, are they recovered? It's, has their funding run out, or do they have more funding, so keep them here longer or let them out sooner, depending on the financial aspect. But what they found is that they can boost their, how good their program looks to get, you know, just to make more money by adding a 12-step recovery program. Because when the addicts leave, those addicts stay sober longer. And those programs are actually spiritual. They help people who are self-centered and, you know, usually agnostic, atheist, or just resentful at religion in general, develop a concept of a higher power, and that, and those addicts that recover say that's why they're sober.
Right.
It's not their own willpower; it's that higher power.
Right.
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 Yeah.
My spiritual master wrote me a letter, and he said, the way a spiritual person thinks is that I don't have ability. So I pray to God, give me ability, give me intelligence. It's a dependent relationship. It's just going to juxtapose from that. I'm going to do it all myself. I'm the controller. It's also nice because there's a freedom from anxiety. There's a dependence. That, you know, I'm dependent on you for guidance, for intelligence. The 12-step program is amazing. Amazingly spiritual. And you can apply that to anything, even if you're not addicted. Just that their whole philosophy is that, just like we're practicing spiritual life, we're talking about all these principles. You might look at all these principles and, well, I don't know if I can do all that. So if we took these principles into a 12-step program, you would say, I'm powerless to do this, but there's a higher power that can help. And you surrender to that higher power. And by the surrender, you're able to control your mind and senses. Ordinarily, you couldn't. And that's spiritual life. You can achieve what you could not achieve ordinarily through spiritual power. In a form of kind of helplessness. I can't do it.
And then you gain the ability to do true service, because you can share that surrender with someone else.
Yes.
And it's really something that's in everyone. It's not like you have to put it there. It's just that you have to awaken it in them. And you, by gaining that realization, you have the unique opportunity to, like, help someone realize that themselves.
So, can everyone close their eyes for a minute? You have 10 more minutes or 5 more minutes? Okay, because we can do two things. So you have to close your eyes. Because we're going to do a vote. There's two things we could do right now. I don't know if we have time for both, maybe. But if we don't, one thing is we could break up into partners. And when I teach this at the yoga studios, we just break up into partners, and then the partner will, or you take a little time on your own and you choose a yama or a niyama that you recently had an experience with, either a positive one or a negative one. If it was positive, you can sort of celebrate that and share with your partner, you know, why and how you were able to do that. And if it was a positive, you could talk about that and think about a way you could relive it and make it that you know, made the right choice, you did the right thing. So that's fun. You get to engage with your partner and a little self-reflection, a little swadhyaya. Or I can tell you a story. So raise your hand if you want to do the first thing with the partners. Okay, raise your hand if you want the story. Okay, we're doing the story. You were the only one that voted for the other thing.
They're all afraid.
It's fun. It's really one of the funnest parts of practical, you know, applying it to...
Do both?
Okay. Close your eyes.
How come he gets the swing the vote?
No. The question wasn't fair because it was an either or. So you may have wanted the story so badly, but you wanted to do the other, but you had to choose.
Well, thanks for understanding my heart despite my vote.
So I think you can do both.
Okay, what do you want to do first?
The story?
Okay, I haven't told it in a while, so I have to. It's not fresh in my mind, but because you talked about the modes of nature, right? Okay, so this is a story called The Three Modes of Nature. So once upon a time, there was a soul. And the soul came from a different atmosphere. And he appeared on the Earth planet. And we'll just call the soul Das. And is it okay with the ladies if we make the soul a boy? Okay, so we'll just make the soul a boy. So the soul was just this pure light consciousness individual. And he just landed on the planet. It was just his time to live out his life on this Earth planet. But he didn't know what to do. He didn't know where to go. He just sort of, you know, floating, walking around, trying to figure it all out. And he met another person. And that person's name was Sattva Gun. And Sattva means goodness, or the mode of goodness. So he said, "Welcome, Das. Welcome to this world. I am Sattva. It's so nice to meet you. Here, take my hand. Let's go take a walk in the beautiful countryside." So Sattva Gun took Das to the most magnificent place on Earth. Even like better than Hawaii. There was beautiful ocean and beautiful mountains and beautiful forests and beautiful gardens. Every direction he looked in was the most spectacular view. And then they sat down on this grass, this lawn that was like as soft as velvet. And then Sattva Gun said, "Here, let's have a nice picnic." So he took out some wonderful fresh fruit and fresh vegetables and sparkling water, and they just had this beautiful picnic. And Sattva and Das were just really, really enjoying nature. All of a sudden, Das felt somebody tapping him on the back. And he turned around and he saw this man and he said, "Hello, I am Rajas. Come with me." And he pulled Das away, and all of a sudden, within a moment, they weren't in the country anymore. They were in the city. They were in, like, the most busy city in the entire world, and there was a freeway right in front of them, and the cars were going zoom, zoom, just swooshing by. And there were lights flashing everywhere from big Broadway-type plays going on, and there were billboards advertising every possible thing you could want. And the phone started ringing, and people were calling. And so Rajas got Das a job. He got him a job, a big corporate job in a high tower building. And he got him a girlfriend. And he got him this big house, and he got him, like, the latest iPod and the latest iPad and, like, the latest everything of anything anybody could ever have. And he was, like, really living it up. And then all of a sudden, he felt this tap on the back. And he turned around, and there was this kind of really weird-looking guy with, like, lots of hair, and he just looked, like, really dirty, and he actually kind of smelled. And passion just disappeared. And then all of a sudden, Tamas, the mode of ignorance, was, like, right there. "Hello, thoughts. Come with me." And Das, you know, see, Das was just, he was very impressionable. He hadn't figured out how to make his own choices and decisions yet, so he was just, you know, like a teenager or something who just gets really easily influenced by his peer association. So, come on, come with me. So in one hand he had a bottle of liquor and they were chugging it down. And the other hand he was like smoking all kinds of things. And he went to Thomas's apartment and it was so dirty. I mean, there was just stuff everywhere. And they just like lie down on the couch and turned on some really dumb TV show. And they were drinking and smoking and the phone rang. But Thomas said, "I don't get it. It's too much trouble to get that phone." So, and then they were hungry, but then Thomas said, "Oh, it's just too much trouble to get up and get something to eat." So they were, then they just started crying over how depressing life was. You know, they don't have this and they don't have that, and they're just too lazy to get up and do anything, and they have a headache, and they're hungry, and they're thirsty, and it was just like really, really low energy. So then he got another tap from Sattva Goon, and Sattva was like, "Come, remember the fruit, the vegetables, the spring water, the mountains, the ocean, the meadows." And he was like, "Yeah, yeah, that sounds really nice." And he went over there for a little while. And then he got a tap on the back from Pash. He said, "Come on, we gotta go. We're in debt, and we gotta go make some money in Las Vegas, and come on, we gotta go to the slot machines, and your girlfriend's really upset with you, because she wants more of this, and she wants more of that, and she's not happy, and we gotta get in the car, we're late," and, you know, it was just, like, so many problems. He had so many problems that needed to be taken care of, and it put him in so much anxiety, and then Thomas was pulling him, and he was just being pulled and pushed, and it just, everything was a headache. Even the mode of goodness wasn't perfect because it just wasn't spiritual. You know, it wasn't going to solve the problems of birth and old age and disease and death. And even if he was a goodness, he could be pulled down to, you know, passion, or he could be pulled down to, it was a cycle and he couldn't get out of it. So then all of a sudden in the distance, he saw this being that was just full of light, kind of like, you know, we were talking about Brahmacharya before, someone who had so much ojas, who had so much energy and so much light and so much illumination. And that person turned out to be a devotee of God. And so that person came and took Das by the hand and he gave him a book. And it was a spiritual book, and Das opened up the book, and they read it together, and it talked about how the three modes of material nature can just entrap you and ensnare you and entangle you so that you can never get to this fourth place, which is called Sudasattva, which is pure goodness, or the first step in transcendence, the first step in transcendental goodness. And from that place, one can learn about their spiritual nature. They can get the answers to who I am, where I come from, where am I going. They can feel the connection to the divine source within. So, Das had a really hard time, but he left it all. He left the goodness, he left the Hawaii, and he left the girlfriend, and he left his friend in the apartment with the drinking and the smoking, and he became in the energy of Sudasattva, and he became a spiritual, elevated yogi. That was my story. Yeah.
Thank you.
And
he lived happily ever after.
And he lived happily ever after.
Would you
get
the story?
Well, it's actually a play that's been done. And I've seen the play a couple times, so I just like to tell the
pretty well done story. Yeah, that's nice.
Thank you. A little rusty, but it's nice. I think it exemplifies, you know, how we're just, you know, until we're spiritually living on the spiritual platform, we're just not quite in our rightful position.
It seemed like from the story, we're just that. He didn't really have a choice.
He
kept saying, he's tapped on the shoulder and then he's pulled away. So
yeah.
It's almost like,
yeah.
It's almost like these different associations were just controlling him completely, and he had no ability to do anything except after the tap go wherever Sattva or Raja or Tama took him.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. And it seems like the things that really saved him were, you know, one was, you know, getting control over his mind and having the strength to say no. And then the connection with the divine person, with the spiritually minded person. You know, being whatever company or association we're in, we become like that. So if we're in the association of godly people, then it rubs off on us. We become godly. And if we're in the association of ungodly people, that rubs off on us too. And I think everybody has that experience in their own lives. You know, there are people you spend time with that you make you feel really good, and you feel very elevated in their association. And there are other people in our lives where we leave and we just feel so polluted, you know. So yeah, a lot of it's about connecting and associating and controlling the mind. I don't know if you've talked about that at all, but the mind, you know, is a powerful thing. And when we control it, we have the ability to make the right choices. And when we let it control us, then we're powerless. We've disempowered ourselves. So, yeah. Do you want to add to that?
Well, I think it's a good point she's making, because it almost seems like we're not in control. But we always have a little degree of choice. It just gets harder the lower down you go. It's more difficult to exert that choice. But a lot of times we're in situations and the forces of this world are so powerful and we feel like I can't do anything. But it's important to remember you always can do something.
It seemed like when you were saying this, telling the story, like once the association of the divine being, and then he read a book, a spiritual book or whatever.
Yeah.
From that knowledge, the intelligence was able to control the mind, like by getting the association and by getting the knowledge.
Yeah. Plus he had had it.
Yeah, he was materially exhausted.
He was a little burned out, and that helps. You know, it definitely helps when you're just, you know.
If you think have some other choice besides surrendering everything. Like,
I think when I walked in, you were talking about that. That people who, if things get too good, you know, it's really easy to forget about our rightful position. You know, it's really easy to forget about God when you have so many things, you know, going your way. And you have, you know, the best of everything, because you feel like you are a mini god. But when life hands you a humbled deck, you know, not your whole life, but you find yourself in some humbled situation, some uncomfortable situation, that's a great impetus to say, oh yeah, I'm not going to fall for this again. That's why they say disease, like in Ayurveda, it says disease isn't bad, symptoms of disease are good. Because it tells you that something's wrong, so you can go and take care of it. If you didn't have the symptoms, you wouldn't know that you were sick, and you could never go to the doctor and get it taken care of. So when something doesn't feel right or feel good, or you're suffering, or there's some kind of pain, that can be a great impetus to go for something higher and better, you know, to embrace, you know, the spiritual instead of the gunas, the modes, and the modes, you know, they don't get any better. They're just what they are, and they'll keep us
wrapped up
tightly. Yeah, and I think it's interesting also now that you're like learning what the gunas are, because I do this with myself sometimes. Oh gosh, it's my phone. I'll just turn it off. Because generally throughout the day, we most ordinary human beings are going back and forth between all the modes. You know, we have our moments of being in the mode of goodness when we're very feeling very alert and very focused. Maybe we're studying, or maybe we made the right choice in the meal we're going to eat, or we're not, you know, hurrying through something, or we've just cleaned our house, or, you know, there are activities that put us in the mode of goodness. And then there are things, you know, we're rushing, we're busy, we're like, you know, eating our breakfast really fast, we're jumping in the car and we forgot something and we got to run back, or, you know, there's just things that we haven't taken care of, we have to do, and we do it quick and we make a mistake, you know, passion. And then there's ignorance where we just get overcome, like we're lazy or we're sleepy or we sleep too much or we don't feel like doing that. So it's nice to observe, you know, the dips and the changes, the highs and the lows throughout the day to see, to recognize what modes you're going through during what points of the day, and you know, try and get out of it. Try and get out of the lower modes. I mean, goodness is not easy. You know, we're not really in the mode of goodness that often. So at least if we could get our way up to goodness, and then, you know, up even higher by, you know, taking hold of a spiritual book, or, you know, connecting with people that are spiritual, or chanting some mantras or whatever. But it's just really, it's part of the self-observance practice to see what modes most dominate us. And most of us are dominated by one or two modes, and we generally oscillate back and forth between the two. I mean, some may be dominated by goodness and passion. Most are, you know, ignorance and passion. But take a note, take a look, see, and when you're in the mode of goodness, think, okay, I want to be that way more.
But also, different times of day are in different modes. So if you get up early, the atmosphere is already, it's in the mode of goodness, so you'll naturally be that way. I had this funny experience when I was 16. My friends and I were going out to the beach, and surfers go early in the morning, so it's about 6 o'clock in the morning. And we're driving, and the person who's van, he's the wildest amongst us. You know, so we're all like 16, 17. It's like 6 in the morning, and he turns on the radio, you know, rock and roll blasting. And everyone in the van said, turn that off, it's too early for that. So even though we're 16 years old, still that morning, that mode of goodness is so strong that, you know, we're all these 16-year-old passionate surfer, and we're all musicians, and, you know, play rock and roll music. And even at 6 in the morning, we couldn't stand to hear it. So he was somehow passionate at 6 in the morning, but we were... So that's a very good time to chant, to do your study, do your spiritual practice, because you don't have to fight the other modes.
Am I kind of, okay, so now we're going to do the other thing, right?
If they want. You guys want to take a break first? I think we should take a break.
Okay. I mean, we don't have to do it.
Let's take a break and see when we come back. Bathroom, water... Wake up, oxygen.
Yes.
You have a Dunder Carton? Keep you guys awake for 45 more minutes.
Yes.